Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
I want to tell you my secret now. I see dead people.
Silent Green is people!
No. I am the Father.
What's in the box?
You maniac! You blew it up! Damn you all to hell!
Hello and welcome to Slate's spoiler specials for Friday, September 20th. I'm June Thomas. I'm the senior managing producer of Slate Podcasts, and I am here to talk about Downton Abbey. I'm not going to tell you who I'm with yet because I want you just to be thinking, are they bringing back the band? Is the band getting back together? Yes, I'm here with Seth Stevenson. Hello, Seth Stevenson.
Hello, June. It's like we never left this podcast studio.
We didn't. It's only been, 4 years since the last episode of Downton Abbey slunk off of PBS. And yet here we are again, ready to talk about the shenanigans upstairs and downstairs.
Times are changing. History rolls forward. But Downton...
Downton remains. I talked about a band that requires musical instruments. Do you have any musical instruments?
June, I had my valet climb deep into the catacombs, the storage catacombs of Stevenson Abbey to dig out an old instrument.
Oh.
This is the bell. If you didn't listen to June and I in the past, this is a bell we would often use to summon hot towels or a small glass of brandy when we needed to as we were podcasting.
Oh, when I needed my frocks to be adjusted.
Which was all the time.
All the time.
Never stopped adjusting your frocks.
I know.
Mid-podcast, you'd be like, I need this hem. It's down to my heel, but I need it further out.
longer.
And so you would ring
the royal ladysmith.
The seamstress, or maybe even the queen's seamstress.
Yeah. When I really want a nice kleptomaniac to sort me out.
The light-fingered... Seems the Queen. We're already getting ahead of ourselves.
We're already talking
about the film.
So, Downton Abbey, the television show, has been away for 4 years, but guess what? They've made a movie.
They made a movie out of it.
Before we get into spoiling all the things that are to be spoiled, can I just say, I kind of loved going back to Downton, and I was thoroughly sick of the thing by the end of the TV show. It just felt like they were repeating themselves. But I was kind of glad to have a little bit of all those old familiar faces and old familiar themes again.
I fully agree. The TV show had run its course, and you and I, it felt, to be honest, a bit of starting to edge into drudgery at the end.
It was, to say the least.
Becoming a bit of a death march at the end as we were recapping these episodes. But a little time away, absence makes the heart grow fonder.
It certainly does.
I was also thrilled. We sat there in the screening room and I didn't know what to expect. But as it began and the music swelled up and the camera swooped over the grand dame that is that house. And I was once again just transported to another world, and I enjoyed it the whole time. I was never bored. I was delighted the entire time, and I was left with a warm feeling in my heart.
I was too. I also, you know, I did feel like my expertise was coming to bear because the opening scene was an echo of the opening scene of S1E1. I don't know if you remember, but in the opening scene of the very first episode of the show, a telegram was being sent and for the inhabitants of Downton Abbey to tell them that their heir and Lady Mary's fiancé had been lost in the Titanic.
Tragically died. Geez.
And we saw, you know, and it was like, oh my goodness, this message needs to be conveyed. And this time we had a message and it was conveyed actually very dramatically. And, you know, we saw the Royal Mail being sorted on a train making its way swiftly northward toward Yorkshire. And it was like thrilling. I felt, oh, an Easter egg that I get to munch on without any need to have my dress pulled out. And yet it was also like a happy, instead of this endless kind of you know, round and round about the inheritance or an inheritance or the entail in all of that business. This was now potentially at least a happy thing. It was that the King and Queen of England, King George V and his wife Mary, were going to come to Yorkshire, and they wanted to stay at Downton Abbey.
So when I heard there was going to be a movie, first of all, I jumped in the air and said, huzzah!
Huzzah!
And then I thought about what sort of plot will they center this film on? And I assumed that it would be some historical event, that it would, you know, how can we entwine Downton Abbey with some sort of historical event that everyone's familiar with and add some drama through that borrowed interest. But instead, it was just like this fun visit from the King and Queen. And I think that was a great choice, actually, not to try to like ratchet up the dramatic stakes too much. It was basically a fun 3 episodes of Downton Abbey crammed into one movie. Yeah. And I think it was a really good choice.
Yeah. It's striking that they were able to bring back pretty much everyone who survived to the end of the TV show is back for the movie. And that's kind of too many people to give like real storylines to. So some of them, like Cora, basically just gets to do some off-screen conniving.
Yes, she did almost nothing. Served to sort of cement that, their relationship is in a good state and Downton is in good hands.
Exactly. So like not everybody got a lot to do, but the small stakes, actually, I agree with you, Seth, for the most part, felt like a relief. Okay, so let's start with those stakes. The royals are coming. First, we're reminded that Carson has left the building. He's now retired. He's working in his garden. He's married to Mrs. Hughes still. They appear to be happy, but he's no longer butling. Now, Thomas is the butler in the house. But when the royal visit is announced and you know, they realize there's going to be all kinds of things happening, Thomas seems to kind of lose his grip a little bit.
He gets a little overexcited. And so the upshot of this is Mary senses that Thomas Barrow is losing control of the whole situation. And Mary has a freak out and goes to, you know, to her rock, Carson. They've always had this close relationship.
They have.
Mary goes to Carson and says, I don't think Thomas Barrow can handle this. Carson, will you come back? Now, I want to say a few things. First of all, this is sort of rude on Mary's part. Mm-hmm. I mean, she didn't really even give Thomas much of a chance to find his footing. I mean, if I got a message saying the King and Queen are coming, I would be a little thrown off my game for like a little bit.
He fits in.
He still had time to recover and get it together, but she just wasn't going to mess around. She was just like, nope, we need Carson here. Carson's the one who can handle us. I found that a little bit rude on her part, a little bit dismissive of Thomas Barrow's abilities. I'm not sure that Carson did a fantastic job. I mean, we'll get into what happens, but Carson basically oversees a coup in a really ineffectual way where he doesn't like manage to prevent it or try that hard to prevent it or encourage it. He just kind of sits there and lets a coup happen on his watch. So I wouldn't say necessarily that we got improved performance from Carson. The other thing I want to say about Carson is I don't think that this movie will garner a lot of Academy Awards interest, but I do think there could be one Best Supporting Actor Award awarded to Carson's eyebrows.
Oh.
Which were in incredible form.
Amazing.
Had a really evocative performance from his eyebrows, I felt like, that had me gripped. And I felt there was like character development over the course of the film from the eyebrows.
Wow.
The way they behaved at the beginning, the waggles at the beginning were different from at the end. There was an arc.
So they'd really grown?
An arc. They'd grown. Mm-hmm. And the arc of the eyebrows, both the physical arc of them, like their
literally,
shape,
yeah,
but also the character arc, the narrative arc of the eyebrows was amazing.
Wow.
Anyway, that's what I had to say.
I want to add 2 things about Carson, if I may. So the first is there were 2 occasions that I noted where they kind of threw out some of the continuity or some of the facts from the show for the movie. One of them was Daisy, who just seemed to be living in the house just as much as she always had. Whereas, in fact, at the end of the TV show, she was off to live with her father-in-law, Mr. Mason, at the farm. But whatever. And then the second thing was that Carson, one of the reasons that he left, it wasn't just that he was ready to retire. That would be much too sensible. It was that he had developed a sort of palsy, and so that he really couldn't handle the the buttling work anymore. Yes. And that just seemed to have been forgotten also.
That very delicate decanting of the wine that the king's page of the backstairs, let us not call him a butler, the king's page of the backstairs was doing that incredibly delicate decanting of the wine where he has to turn this little lever or this little crank to decant the wine ever so slowly. There's no way a man with a palsy could have handled that.
But yet, that was just forgotten. But
I was glad to see Carson back.
I was too. Oh, and the second thing I want to mention about Carson, and this is more about the sort of behind the scenes rather than beneath stairs. But another of the storylines in this episode above stairs was involved Violet, the Dowager Countess, getting into a scheming situation.
As always.
With Lady Bagshaw, Maud Bagshaw, who was played by Imelda Staunton, great British actress, who is also the real-life wife of the actor who plays Carson.
June, these are the kinds of details that you bring to this podcast.
She's a great British actress. She's a fine singer, too, as it happens, but she wasn't called upon to do that this particular time around. Okay, so back to the plot. So, as I mentioned, Violet, the Dowager Countess, played by Maggie Smith, now has something else to worry about, which is whether this person we've never heard of before.
Yes, I thought, as she was introduced, I was like, was I supposed to know who this is? And I suddenly was like, have I forgotten huge patches of the television show? Who is this person?
All credit to the people behind Downton Abbey that they were able to find a British actor or actress of stature who had not yet already been cast in Downton Abbey.
He thought everyone else had already been there.
And Imelda Staunton is one of the rare British actors who kind of toggles between play and posh and common. She does both, whereas most people are assigned one or the other. So, you know, the fact that she came in as a posh person in the movie, maybe that was kind of why she was still available, so to speak. But yes, she is a royal lady in waiting. You know, so she's minor aristocracy. She's a widow. Her husband died in the Boer War, but she now is, you know, one of the Queen Mary's ladies in waiting. And Violet is trying to persuade her. She's apparently a distant cousin of Violet and Robert and the Crawleys. And Violet is trying to persuade her to give her estate, to give her inheritance to Robert because he's her nearest relative. And she is apparently not down with that plan.
Yes. Well, heaven forbid there not be some sort of succession drama.
Indeed.
You know, some sort of inheritance controversy and a codicil to a will.
To an entail. Yeah.
And a scheming. Yes. Yeah. I really felt like, was this a plot point from the series that I completely forgot? Because they just introduced it as though you were exposed to know that this was happening. And of course this would happen. But I'm glad to hear that I had not forgotten about it.
No. And that's one of the things, actually, that I was grateful for in the movie, that they just acted like everybody knows who everybody is, because everybody will. Anybody who sees this movie will have seen the TV show or be on a date with somebody who has.
Yes,
but, like, they didn't. I'm glad they didn't bother to introduce things because, like, no need.
Yeah, I agree. This was for veterans. This was not for noobs.
Right. No.
And so they were like, you know what? We're on the same page here. Here's a question I had about this inheritance controversy, which is, isn't Violet's son already having trouble with the upkeep on his massive estate? Isn't the last thing he needs, like, another huge estate to deal with and the upkeep and the responsibility to the hangers-ons and
the
all
the tenants, we'd like to call them rather than hangers-on.
The tenants, to be more respectful. I feel like that's exactly what he doesn't want. Unless the estate is just a bunch of gold bars sitting in a vault, like, does he really want more acreage and another, like pile of bricks that need to be repointed? Like, what?
Yeah.
He didn't seem that interested in this.
No, I agree. He didn't seem like he cared. But we need something for Violet to scheme over. And
Violet needs, more importantly, perhaps Violet needs something to scheme over.
Exactly. You know, I'm going to go a little bit ahead of myself and say that I was slightly disappointed in the quality of zingers that were supplied to Violet this episode. Were you satisfied with them?
You had zinger regret.
It just felt a little bit slightly muted. Not total duds, but just like, is that the best you got? You remember on the TV show, they used to put together entire trailers of her zingaroos.
Oh, yes. Here's how I'll respond to you, June. What piffle you talk. I don't even remember if she said that. Somebody said that, but it was a pretty good zinger that came out. No, I see. I hear what you're saying. I would rate what you say as 25% piffle.
Uh-huh.
I think I know what piffle is. I contextually, I
it's
sort
like
of
understand. It's like codswallop.
all again, yeah. contextually, I understand what Codswallop and Piffle are. I don't literally know what they are. Yeah. I'm not sure I want to know literally what they are.
No, no.
But there was one that stuck out for me from her, which was, wait, what was it? Oh, yes. She said, "Will you have enough cliches to get you through the visit?" Which I thought was pretty good. That was a pretty decent zinger. And she also said, somebody compared her to Machiavelli, and she said, Machiavelli had many qualities. Those were okay. There were a few decent
Caligula
ones.
Caligula was also brought into that particular comparison.
I hear what you're saying, though. I did have to look to my notes, to be fair. I had to look in my notes to find. They weren't just like on the top of my head.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I have to say, I was surprised that below stairs, the people who were given storylines were Thomas, which we'll get to, but also Daisy. Daisy is really beloved of the Downton Abbey writers. And she actually got lines saying things like, I mean, sometimes it's things like, they're all mental or this is rubbish. But also things like, we're not footballs, Mr. Bates, and we don't deserve a kicking. You know, things like that, which, you know, for this show and this writer's room, which is, I understand it is just Lord Fellows, then, you know, that's what counts as like, woohoo.
Yeah. Daisy did get a little bit more of a presence than I was expecting. She had a full storyline and everything. Yeah.
Which was a complete repetition of the thing that she had twice around with William.
That's true. Lord Fellows isn't one on like, you know, breaking out a brand new set of tools. He really likes just to dust off the old tools and use they worked what worked
tricks.
In the past.
Exactly.
Let's give it another go. Exactly. And I mean, like we said, this movie was for people who've seen the show.
Yeah.
I don't think you wanted something like a radical departure from, you kind of wanted the same thing over again.
Yeah, and we got it. So thank you, Lord Fellows.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, so as we sort of hinted at earlier, the royals are coming, the king and queen. And then while Thomas is being a bit dithery and Carson is being brought in to sort of help him sort stuff out, we learn that, in fact, never mind. This is after we've seen Mrs. Patmore and Daisy go down to the local shop where the local greengrocer is just thrilled beyond belief to, you know, supply lard and beef stock for the royal meal.
The highlight of his, not just his professional career, but of his life, June.
His life.
He makes very clear, this is the peak of his life.
Indeed.
To supply some, like, Crisco for the king.
Some tallow. And so Mrs. Patmore hasn't got the heart to tell him, actually, we're not making the royal meal, because they learn, or have learned at that point, that actually when the royals, when the king and queen go on tour, they bring an entire set of retainers that take care of all that stuff.
That move in like in elaborate coordination, where one set is like doing the advance work for the next house, and this one's here. And as soon as this one gets the set up of the house, they're on to like two houses down the line. Yeah. It's a real military operation.
Yeah, that actually kind of made my head hurt a little bit and didn't totally make sense. But we understood a little while later why they bothered to give us all that setup. But this delighted me in a way, because it gave the downstairs people something to plot about, which, as we've established, plotting and scheming is what Downton's all about.
It's the fuel.
But it was a little aggravating to me, but not at all surprising, that what the downstairs people ended up getting up in arms about and rebelling about was not the fact that they are vassals to the aristocracy.
Oh, no.
But to fight against a whole other set of commoners who are themselves dedicated to serving the aristocracy. And in fact, while the aristocrats and the royals who we saw were, to a man and woman, the very soul of gracious, sort of less majesty, the servants were just horrible people. The steward of the back stairs, or whatever his
page
name.
Page of the
back stairs. Excuse me, the page
June.
Of the back stairs. The woman who, Mrs. Webb, who was the housekeeper.
The kleptomaniac
and then
seamstress.
The kleptomaniac seamstress and Monsieur Corbet, the cook, were revolting, arrogant, hideous people.
Terrible people. And Andy, Daisy's fiancé, like, tries to sabotage the visit by ruining the boiler in a fit of pique.
Exactly.
Like, they're all just these, like, it can't control their emotions,
right.
Rough around the edges, get arrested. not Thomas's fault, but
right.
Yes, they're like rabble, like hot-headed rabble, as opposed to the serene, yes, exactly,
yeah,
gracious
yeah.
people upstairs. Let's get into the broader politics a
yes.
little bit later, but
yes,
the politics of this I found extremely annoying.
Yes. Another person I was surprised who made a comeback to serve the royals and eventually did so was Molesley, who had finally been given a little bit of dignity and a vocation at the end of the TV show when he was found to be, of all things, a sort of like a teacher savant, like he was the world's greatest educator. And
yes,
so
he found some direction
yeah.
away from like being a servant. And he, yes, exactly, some dignity, some self-worth. But no, the king and queen job, drop everything, allow me to prostrate myself
exactly.
before them, allow me to need, like, literally curtsy and
literally.
Lose all dignity in
all
front of the king and
gone.
Queen.
Gone. But anyway, so he also got a storyline.
June, I do want to tell our listeners, June and I watched this in a screening room together in Manhattan, and we sat next to each other, and we had a great time. And when Molesley showed up on screen, June went, "Moles!" She got so excited, really added
well,
to the experience.
Well, yes. And I was like, oh, but also, hey!
Moles!
Mr. M, how you doing? Yes. Okay, so there's something which I'll just mention, but it was so pointless that even by Downton standards, it seemed like the equivalent of like the tail that we all have somewhere vestigially on our persons and our skeletons, which was that Princess Mary, the Princess Royal, the King and Queen's oldest daughter.
Yes, who I Wikipedia'd, so I'm prepared.
Good. She now lives up north. She now lives in Harewood, I believe, the sort of next big house over.
Married to a gruff, cold, noble, 15 years her senior.
Who is just a dick.
Yes.
Like, there's no other word for it.
Just likes to hunt and ignore his children and be a dick.
Oh, and so, like, the Queen, when Lady Mary and Cora and I guess Grandma, I can't remember, come over, and they are kind of worried about it because they're, I guess the word is out that she's not happy. And then she, it's so clear that when the children are brought in, like off schedule, but still the children are brought in, she is just sort of transformed. Her face lights up. She clearly loves, adores her children. And then her husband comes in and like kicks out the kids because kids aren't allowed in the drawing room until 6 p.m. or something. And so she's very unhappy. He's a horrible, controlling husband. There's like something else happens, but it's like, what is the point of that?
It was very weird to bring in that real life character.
Yeah, yeah.
And the only arc there is that she is convinced by Tom Branson to stay with her terrible husband,
right.
Which is odds. It's like they wanted to have a real life royal who they could have the people of Downton somehow like affect her life.
Mm-hmm.
But then the effect on her life was like that nothing will change and she'll stay with this terrible man who she shouldn't stay with.
Right.
I also felt she was sort of carefully, when I Wikipedia'd her and learned a little bit about, she did not go to Queen Elizabeth's wedding in protest because the Duke of Windsor was not invited to the wedding.
Oh.
The abdicator was not invited to the wedding. And so in protest, Princess Mary did not go to Queen Elizabeth's
wow.
wedding.
Well, he was her brother, of course.
Yes, he was her brother, and
yeah,
so she had a soft spot for him. But she is remembered as in like an uncontroversial royal. I guess she didn't have too many black marks against her,
uh-huh.
you know, maybe not attending the wedding, but there, people understood why she wouldn't attend the wedding.
Loyalty.
She's basically like a very uncontroversial royal, so I guess they felt they could bring her in without really saying too much one way or the other,
yeah.
and then have a storyline where like Tom Branson changes the path of her life in which the path just continues.
Right. And then we know, of course, that in the current generation, now we're at the stage where royals divorce.
But not her.
The world hadn't changed that much yet.
Yes, Mr. Branson, times are changing,
yes,
but not fast
but not,
enough for Princess Mary.
Exactly. So the other thing that's happening with the royals, they're going to like have dinner at Downton.
They arrive in like a single car.
Yes.
They just arrive in one motor car, the King and Queen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
There's like no entourage at all. It just seemed really, that seemed odd to me.
Poor security too, which will be a bit of a theme.
It will.
But they arrive. They're going to come and stay at Downton, and they're going to see a parade. The Yorkshire Hussars are going to parade in front of them. So the king's going to be on his horse, and they're going to be,
In his finery.
And then the next day there's going to be a ball at Harewood, and that's the thing that involves the royals.
It's a parade, a dinner, and then the next day at a different
venue.
House, a mm-hmm. different venue that the servants of Downton are not responsible for.
Indeed.
There will be a ball.
Indeed.
That's the order of events.
Indeed.
And then they will move, the tour will continue.
Exactly. They come here, everything's fine, they're kind of nice. But then there's this plot line, which I have to say my heart sank when this grim-faced Major Chetwood shows up and takes an interest in Tom Branson. And it just felt like the worst elements of the show. We didn't quite see his horns, but like he just was presented like, oh, look, he's a bad guy, you know.
He's like wearing a hat and skulking around for no apparent reason that he's skulking, but he is.
Yeah.
He's wearing like a trench coat and it just has a face that looks like, oh, you're up to no good.
Rather a handsome chap, but he was clearly being given the baddie edit. Mm. So, like, there's some bullshit with Tom, but we're just
kind of like vaguely anti-Irish.
Really, exactly, which is just about as much credit as I can give it. But basically, Tom's loyalty was being tested.
The
Republican who we know when he first came to Downton was an Irish Republican. And he eventually married, of course, your favorite, Lady Sybil. Was widowed, stayed on at Downton, became, you know, now he and Mary's husband, who was weirdly absent during the movie.
That was like the sitcom where the guy's making a movie and they're like, you can't be in the episode. We offer a brief, unconvincing explanation for his absence.
And then he shows up at the end. And also, like, his name, like, by contractual obligation, I can only assume, is above Maggie Smith's credits. So it's Matthew Good, Maggie Smith.
That is weird.
That's so strange.
I wonder what he had to do that was so important, Matthew Good, that you couldn't show up with Lady Mary. And Lady Mary got a nice new bob, forget. A really nice new bob for this movie.
She did.
And yet Matthew Good couldn't be bothered to show up and support her. Anyway,
I've
taken this off track.
It's all right. So
Branson and Mary are sort of jointly running the Downton estate, keeping
the
books.
He and her husband have a car
Some sort
store.
Of automotive enterprise.
Exactly.
I don't even fully understand what it is. And it's like in an alley. He's got like car stuff.
Exactly. But clearly he is still loyal. And his daughter, Sibby, hangs out with Mary's kids, with the Marchioness is in town. Like she hangs with the kids of her generation. And so clearly he is loyal
Tom
to the Crawley family.
Folded into the family quite clearly.
But then when somebody comes to town with nefarious purposes, he immediately seeks out Tom. But then in the most desultory way that I can't possibly even give credit to, Tom, when the king is completely open and available for shooting on his horse.
wide open, no security, nobody
even looking down a back alley. Tom single-handedly, well, actually not quite single-handedly, because Mary, who is distrustful of Tom, kind of chases him and gets in the way. When Tom brings down Major Chetwood, and, is wrestling over the gun, Mary swoops in and grabs the gun, and Major Chetwood is arrested and the king is saved. And like, yeah, there you go. Thanks.
That whole storyline, which was like the B story, the C minus story. But it's like Tom's going to be maybe the guy is like a private investigator checking on Tom's loyalty on behalf of the king.
That's what we're supposed to wonder.
And we're not sure. But then it turns out he's plotting against the king and trying to rope Tom into his plot. But Tom's not having it. But Mary suspects that maybe Tom is going to be disloyal and is worried about that. And then it's the quaintest regicide attempt I've ever heard. Like one guy with like a little pistol gets like wrestled to. Why did Tom not like alert the authorities? First of all, why did he try to I'll just handle this, he says.
Exactly.
He's like, I'm just going to handle this regicide attempt and thwart it myself, which made no sense. Why wouldn't you?
Made no sense. I can't even attempt to
alert
offer an
the authorities.
To
and no. then he like wrestles the guy to the ground. But there was actual like the king was in grave danger of being shot at from like 20 feet away by this guy. This was a weird,
although,
crazy.
I do love the alternate history that this presents, because if King George V had been shot right then and killed, maybe King Edward VIII would have succeeded before he met Wallace Simpson, and the course of history would have been changed.
The course of history, a fascinating counterfactual history.
But that was not, I hasten to add, suggested or even hinted at in the movie, but my mind was wandering at that point.
It was really silly. I think they needed some kind of action scene, right?
Yep,
they wanted
yep.
some sort yep. of like kinetic, physically robust action mm-hmm. scene, and so mm-hmm. they created this like regicide attempt,
yep.
which was really silly because the second most dramatic like action scene was putting a tarp over chairs in a rainstorm.
Exactly.
And they were like,
can
we get the tarp over these chairs while it's raining? That was like the second
Stakes.
Biggest action scene
yes.
to happen,
yes.
which I'm fine with. I don't need Downton to have big action scenes. Yeah. I could have done without these.
Yeah, because remember the trenches in World War One.
Oh, yeah, that did not go well.
Tarps and rainstorms.
Really silly, although Tom Sparrow still has his little hand cast.
Yeah, he does.
A decade later.
He did shoot himself right there.
Hand cast. Is this a good time to talk about the politics, since we're talking about Tom Branson and his Republican Irish loyalties and all that? So I was sort of fascinated by that, not because of the silly action scene, but because of the politics of this.
And the politics of now?
Because the TV show ended pre-Trump, pre-Brexit, if I'm correct, right?
Yes.
And so this is Downton's first stab at a new plot line post-Brexit, mm-hmm. post-Trump. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to read too much into it, but Lord Fellows has his mm-hmm. has his inclinations, mm-hmm. and I wondered how he might try to vaguely incorporate this into the Downton universe. And what he did was have Tom Branson, who's always sort of tried to balance his loyalty to Ireland with his loyalty to this aristocratic family, and he gives this big speech in the film that's sort of like a climactic. Emotionally climactic speech in the film, which he gives to Princess Mary, and the import of the speech is, you know what, I might have my disagreements politically with these folks, but they're good people. Let's just set them aside, and I am just going to submerge all my personal feelings about justice in order to just let these aristocrats do what they want to do and just like let things roll on. And it really felt to me like a bit of a horrible comment on the politics of our polarized politics of the day, that we should all set aside our very legitimate, important differences about like justice and outcomes mm-hmm. and just get on with each other.
You might say that Tom was the Irish backstop. I mean, it was just, it was. I think that's something that we see over and over again in Downton and have forever, that for obvious reasons, like there's an underlying conservative that is so strong that the only thing that you'll ever hear is, but individuals with good hearts, people who are doing their best to, you know, keep this entire system going for a little bit longer. And of course, we know that system can't go on forever.
It's an incredibly unjust, inequitable system that they are trying to preserve is like, oh, but they're really good people. They're really good. And you know what? They are. They are. I love the Dowager Countess. She's a great person, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, or even showing us the shopkeeper, which, of course, is historically accurate. You would, of course, have gotten your food from the local greengrocer. But I kind of had this feeling of like, well, are you setting that up against what will come, you know, 100 years later of, you know, basically big international supermarkets outside of the towns where you have to get into a car and go and do like where the local shops have gone, the high streets are all the same. Like there was also a little bit of, you know, that conservatism, which also is inevitable. And you know, your local greengrocers are great, but Aldi is cheaper.
And the other thing about this is more about just like the Downton and this film and what it was doing. And this, now I'll shift to something I liked about it, was like a regicide attempt, a massive like political disagreement. All these were actually only done in service of like making the characters have a good, you know, outcome. Like, right. Tom Branson becomes like a really good guy because he stopped the king from being murdered.
Right.
And because he was able to set his politics aside and like for the good of the family. And so it lets him have this nice moment. Another political thing, which I don't want to shoot our fox. This is a British phrase I learned recently, June, shooting our fox. Is that like a widespread one, or did I just learn it from an eccentric English person?
Possibly the latter. Possibly.
Well, I guess my understanding is that to shoot your fox is like to kind of like step on your own, steal your own thunder.
Right. So
shoot your fox.
So you get rid of your
chase. Shot our own fox. So anyway, not to shoot our fox. Maybe we'll get into more later. But also like the Thomas Barrow getting arrested in the gay bar is like it's not presented as like a chance to comment on the horrid like social norms of the day. It's a chance for Barrow to like learn a little lesson and come out okay.
Yes. that scene or that little section, I was up and down about it. So what happens is Thomas goes with one of the royal servants who's kind of dismissed because he's on the next, like, the next batch.
He's already done his advance work and he's about to move on to the next place and do the advance work.
So he gets to go to York to visit his mom because he's got a night off. And since Thomas has been usurped by Carson, he's got a night off too. So they go off to York. And the guy has to go see his mother. So Thomas is in a pub and a guy is making eyes at him. And Thomas has been in this situation before. And so when the guy invites him somewhere, he goes along. He's happy to go along, but he is thrilled and shocked and surprised to find that they're sort of proto-gay bar in York.
Yes, his eyes are open to a whole new world he didn't know existed, with these men dancing with each other and just
kissing and being open. Like, some of them are femme, some of them aren't. They're all handsome. And it does seem like paradise, and it's joyful and happy. And for a man who really has not had that much opportunity for happiness, it's wonderful.
It was kind of nice. And he's just talking about his delight. And I didn't know this existed.
Exactly. And then in come the cops, which again is real, but, is obviously was a tragedy of immense scale, you know, when it was illegal to do what they were doing. And right up until the 70s, I guess. And so, you know, it is a dangerous situation. We know, of course, that the folks at Downton, Robert, know, everyone at Downton knows about that Thomas is gay and they tolerate it. But if he had been charged, prosecuted, then that would mean
just washed our hands of him.
Yeah, that would make him a felon. And so, you know, it would have had serious consequences. But because the guy who took him to York is a member of the royal household, he's able to pull strings.
Can flash his royal
card. Flash his royal card, get him out of jail, I guess, or the holding cells. And then they go off and have...
And it turns out that this fellow is gay. Also gay.
Yeah.
And he reveals this to Thomas, and it's like, it's kind of cute.
Mm-hmm.
And so it ends up Thomas being like, well, what a little adventure I had. And I'd spent like a couple hours in jail. That's okay. And then I met this nice guy, and maybe we're going to see each other again. So instead of like the outcome being like, what a tough life it was for gay people at this time, the outcome is like Thomas had a little adventure and ended up better than he was before.
Exactly. And, you know, and again, it's great that Thomas has love. He's like, the guy really likes him. They have sex. They, you know, they like each other. They're going to have a relationship. So that's wonderful. But, oh, did we have to like go through this big social thing that just became something to toy with in the storyline? But anyway,
thing with Branson. I felt the way he handled the politics of that. Again, it's like this huge thing that's happening historically, like, but it's just a way to have Branson feel good about himself and like get cement his ties with the family.
Exactly. I want to mention one tiny thing which actually delighted me maybe the most of the whole movie, which was that when the king and queen were at the parade or whatever, the Yorkshire Hussars played Ilkley Moor, which is an old Yorkshire song, On Ilkley Moor Bear Tat. Where hast to been since I saw thee? On Ilkley Moor Bear Tat.
Keep going, June.
Where hast to been since...
Never stop. Let's just have the rest of the podcast doing that.
Exactly. And then, of course, it's a song about how, hey, lad, they'll catch thy deer the cowed. And
pardon me?
Then we shall have to bury thee. And then worms will eat thee up, and then we'll eat worms. So it's a song essentially about cannibalism, but it's an old Yorkshire song. And even though this show is set in Yorkshire and a few of the characters, a few, have Yorkshire accents, it always has felt to me that, again, the North is also being misused. And so to actually hear a Yorkshire tune played by the the masked band of the Yorkshire Hussars did feel good. And I was singing along. I don't know if you could hear, but I was singing along.
Oh, I could hear.
Yeah. Okay, good. So there's the user patient, Anna, Mr. Bates, they all... Oh, Mrs. Hughes, too.
The downstairs coup. We're not football's June, and we don't deserve a kicking, as Daisy says. And so they decide they're not going to. So because these royal servants are really giving them the high hat.
They're yeah.
Incredibly snotty. And it's the narcissism of small differences.
Yes.
And they're just taking their like little elevated status and lording it over the Downton staff. And the Downton staff will not put up with that. And the Downton staff, I feel, justifiably thinks they know the house better.
Like, yes.
They know the people better. They know the house better. What? Let us do our thing. And why wouldn't the king and queen want a taste of Yorkshire? Why wouldn't they want a taste of Downton hospitality? It's like you're traveling in a bubble.
Yeah.
So I do think the Downton staff was right to mount this coup.
Absolutely. And the fact is, when the page of the backstairs said...
The king's page of the
backstairs. Yeah, the king's page of the backstairs. When he said that Downton was a minor provincial house and that our friends, the servants, were serving an undistinguished family, that was when we said,
well, you don't know if you remember.
You.
I stood up in my seat and threw my notebook at the screen.
You sure did.
You remember that?
I do. And then you were removed, and then we had
to... I was ejected, and you had to bail me out and show your royal card.
My royal card.
It was the whole thing.
Yeah.
That guy, he was a good villain, I felt like.
Yeah, he always is. I was watching, as I do, an old Midsummer Murders last night, and he was a bicycle...
You know what I just saw him in Saturday Night? For some reason, I watched Four Weddings and a Funeral, the 1994 Hugh Grant, Andy McDowell vehicle.
But
he was good. He did a great job, I felt, as the high-handed servant.
Yeah, those servants who had those thankless roles were all good. Okay, so we need to probably get a little bit of a move on. So, but the
why? Lord Fellows never does. The movie just kind of exists in
And if our podcast is as long as the movie, is that really such a bad thing? So the Downton servants get rid of the royals, send some of them off on a trade.
They give the chef a sleeping draft, the king's page of the backstairs, they lock him in his room, they send all the servants off on a wild goose chase making a prank phone call.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the Downton staff is going to handle the visit.
They are. And they get to put on the royal livery that makes them look like toreadors.
Where does that stuff? That stuff is just kept in the catacombs somewhere and brought out once every 40 years when the king and queen come to visit?
I guess.
They must have
a storage. I've got one in my drawer at work, but along with my slate, office sweater, for when it gets colder.
I love the thought in my Brooklyn apartment, I have in the walk-in, one of the closets way in the back. My royal livery that I bring out once every few decades.
I would need the kleptomaniac lady's maid to adjust mine slightly since the last time I wore it. So they serve dinner. Molesley makes a fool of himself.
Molesley addresses the queen directly.
Directly.
Which he really should have known. Even I, an American commoner, knew that was bad form, Molesley. He directly addresses the queen and then curtsies.
Corrects it.
Which, gender fluid, whatever.
Yeah,
but at that time, I feel, was maybe a faux pas of sorts.
Yeah.
But it was he had good intention because he was trying to inform the queen that, hey, it wasn't your chef who made this. It was Mrs. Patmore. And then I think the queen says our compliments to Mrs. Patmore, or maybe the king does. He mentions Mrs. Patmore and says what a great meal she made.
Yeah. Her name was on their lips.
Exactly.
It's amazing. Okay. So that happens. The other most ridiculous storyline is that the kleptomaniac lady's maid is found out by Anna, who, of course, knows everything, can do anything, and is persuaded to take in Lady Edith's dress. The wrong parcel has been delivered. I knew that was going to be something because they kept saying, "Where's Edith's dress? Where's Edith's dress?" And it came and it was, big enough for all of the sisters to wear. Including the body of Lady Sybil. And
June.
So, I know, sorry. That was out.
R.I.P., get Lady Sybil's name out your mouth.
Exactly. And so, thank you for doing that. And now disappear, please, because that was ridiculous.
What a pointless storyline that was. Why was that
Who was that even to serve? Anna?
Was it the point that even the queen's servants are also of poor moral character? And I didn't understand that. And why, pointless. And then I don't even remember seeing the dress at the ball. It was just so... Pointless.
But for as much as I love Imelda Staunton and Thomas Tuppence Middleton, who, of course, most recently seen by me, at least, on Sense8, one of the greatest shows of the last few years, please watch, Lady Bagshaw's holding out on giving her inheritance to Robert because she wants to give it to her maid, who she calls by her first name, which scandalizes people. Mm. You don't call her by her surname?
She's not Smith. She's Lucy.
She's Lucy. And we learn, what do we learn, Seth?
Well, I thought they were setting it up that, in fact, they had a romantic relationship. For a moment,
I did too.
I thought they were setting it up that she was sort of hiding her girlfriend
which would have been a great storyline.
Right. I thought that's what was going on. But no, it turned out that, in fact, it was her daughter, her illegitimate daughter, who she was concealing.
Yeah. So she'd had an affair with a commoner. And the commoner had been killed in the Boer War. Lady Bagshaw had gone off to America to have the child, had brought her back to England, had educated her, but in a local school, you know, not like a cough, and had hired her as her maid and had told her when she was 18 and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, so this woman, Lucy, like Tom Branson, was sort of oddly between classes.
She's on the precipice of climbing socially, and she's trying to deal with it, and she finds a very sympathetic year in Branson, who has made this leap himself from chauffeur to member of the family, and so they get on very well. But it's not just that they understand each other's situations. There is a spark there.
Yes, and you know, the thing that was, this is a controversial view perhaps, but in the early seasons, certainly the first and second, one thing that Downton did incredibly well was love affairs, romances. It wasn't a rom-com, although I guess there was some com, but like they had really great love stories.
Mary and Cousin Matthew the reason that Downton became Downton.
Exactly.
The season one romance between Mary and Cousin Matthew was what made the show a legitimately good show at times, and what really drew in the masses, and why I liked it, and I think did. It was just... it was great.
Yes.
It was legitimately great. And once he died, the show was never really the same again.
Yeah, exactly.
After, there was just like a faint after echoes of that.
Yeah. And, you know, Sybil and Tom, that was also, you know, a sort of forbidden romance. That was decent. It wasn't quite on the scale of Mary and Matthew, but still it was decent. And then after a while, they kind of, once those love stories had gone away, something very key to the show just... The show went down in quality when there was no more like love sizzle. And this movie, it tried to have two romances, the one with Tom and Lucy and the one with Barrow. And I'm afraid I don't remember the member of the royal household's name.
And the one between me and Carson's eyebrows.
Exactly. And I guess Daisy and Andy, although that really does not seem like it is a relationship that should happen. they just didn't manage that. They couldn't pull that off. They just didn't have any spark. They didn't have any sizzle.
Well, the Tom and Lucy one wasn't established at all. It's sort of like he liked the look of her, great, and then they had like a couple quick conversations, but it just wasn't really established.
No.
She had a very winning smile, and like it kind of like rode on that, and that was that.
Right.
And they
were dancing outside, just as you'll remember. Mary once had a classic outside dance with somebody or other. I remember snow falling.
Love a good outside dance.
But it just wasn't the same. Like, you could see what they were trying for, but
yeah.
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 And I'm not even going to give, again, I keep saying I'm not going to give credit to, but there's also the storyline with Edith getting pregnant and her husband,
that was like the lowest of stakes. Like, he might need to go on a work trip for a little while. Oh, he doesn't. Thank goodness.
Thanks, Cora. Okay, so that happened. But then the final reveal was something that was high stakes, and I didn't really know why it had been revealed, and it upset me.
About the Dowager Countess.
The Dowager C, yeah. So she reveals that in the first sort of section, she disappeared off to London, which seems strange to me because it's not like she just pops to London. She's not that kind of girl. And she didn't say what she was doing. She was very vague. And then she, at the ball at Harewood, she takes Mary aside and she says, I need to tell you what it was. It was some medical tests. And I'm afraid I'm not going to be with you very much longer, but you will kind of carry on my spirit.
I'm anointing you to be the future craggy old woman of Downton and to carry on. Yes.
The holder of the zingers. And like, maybe it was to get some tears going, which it actually didn't for me, even though as much as I adore Violet, Like it just, it felt the, like that's not the way you convey that.
No,
like
the drama fell flat. Yeah. And she, like, there were no hints of her failing health at all. Right. She seemed just exactly the same as she'd always been. And she's just like, there's no like outward sign of this. And she just says, oh, by the way,
I'm dying.
I don't have long to live.
Yeah.
Don't like, let, now let's go dance. Don't worry about it. Not a big deal.
MBD. And so I just kind of wondered, why did they do that? I think it was to give us tears. But also, I think maybe there'll be more Downtons, and they just kind of want to give us heads up.
Yeah.
Don't expect Maggie Smith in the next one.
Heads up. We may not be able to agree to contract terms with Maggie Smith for the next one after this, and we want to give ourselves an out.
Exactly. Which, you know, great, because I'm there. Like, I know you're about to have another child, and I suspect that, you know, he might be going to Downton Abbey 17, you know, just before he heads off to college.
We can only hope.
Yeah, exactly. But... that just kind of didn't do it for me.
Yeah. Well, they end the film with Carson saying, there's some like a conversation about like what's going to happen to Downton. It's 1927 in the year of the film. And like, what's going to happen to Downton? And Carson says, oh, Downton will be here 100 years hence. And like nothing will change. And this will live on forever. And of course, we know it's now almost 100 years later that this is not exactly how things went down.
Yeah.
I looked up, so there are some other comps for Downton mentioned in the film. If you recall, they were like, they mentioned these comparable houses, Arundel and Blenheim and one other one, Chatsworth.
Yes.
Which is to me always the town in the San Fernando Valley where they film pornography.
Chatsworth to me is where the Duchess of Devonshire, who was one of the Mitford daughters, lived until quite recently.
Okay. So they mentioned those as comps.
Yeah.
And I looked up what did become of those real life homes. And so one of them, I couldn't really tell what happened to Arundel, but Blenheim, they had the way that they saved it was one of the heirs married an American, a Vanderbilt heiress, in order to like get the money in order to the upkeep. I don't know exactly what's going on with that house now.
Yeah, one of the great Catholic families of Britain, if I remember correctly.
Ah, okay. And I think the family may even still really live there. Yeah. And like in Chatsworth, it's mostly like museum grounds and open to the public, but like some duke pays market rent for his rooms in it, which I find so kind of what a quaint, funny story that there's this like duke who's like, you know, 17 generations removed from the builders of the house. He's like paying market rent for some 3-bedroom apartment in there.
Right. Well, that's often the case that now they're run by the National Trust and maybe the family still live in them as much as anything else to still have that air of royalty, they're not actually royals, but air of kind of gentry. But they literally rent a room or two and, have the public treading through. Or another thing that they sometimes do is rent out their house for filming shows like Downton Abbey.
Yes.
So that might be another option for Downton in 100 years.
Yeah. Well, they did. I think they ended that way. You know, they were supposed to sort of, you know, nod at the irony of him saying, oh, it'll be 100 years. And we know that, you know, things aren't going to exactly go the way Carson thinks they're going to go. But the movie very specifically chooses this year 1927 where I'm sure lots of things are happening. But like to the modern audience, like that, you don't say 1927. Of course, that's when this happened. Nothing in particular is happening. It's just this like quiet interlude. Yes, there's an assassination attempt at the king, but you know it's thwarted before anything happens. And the king becomes fond of Branson and says, "Oh, I think I owe you one, chap, for saving my life." Just like I think it was a very conscious decision to set it in this quiet interlude where nothing much is happening, and we can just luxuriate in this different time and these different world. Yeah, and I think, I think that was a great choice. It left me with a wonderful feeling. And you know what, June, I would happily do this with you again. Not too, more than 2 years, but less than 7 years from now. Yeah, I would happily luxuriate in another couple of hours of Downton with you.
Me too. And do you recommend it to our listeners?
If you are a Downton fan, which if you're listening,
if you're still listening, you are.
56 minutes into this podcast about this film, you are for sure a Downton fan. If that's you, yes, definitely. I'm sure you've already seen this movie. But if you haven't, yes, this movie's for you. I'm going to go ahead and preemptively recommend, you know, the sequel 3 years from now, because I think it'll just do the same thing again and I'll be happy to see everybody again. And you know what? Let's just carry on.
Yeah. And I wonder who Daisy will be, you know, hesitating down the aisle with then. Who knows?
Oh, what's that? What's that, June? I hear.
Oh, I'm being summoned. I've got to go.
Oh, is that the bell from the Dowager Countess's chambers? I think she needs you to draw a bath.
I do. She wants me to polish her zingers.
Oh, she's quite insistent. She just keeps ringing.
Okay. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Please do subscribe to the spoiler special feed, and we'll be back with you in 2 weeks' time discussing some other movie or perhaps TV show or who knows, maybe even a podcast. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Seth.
Thank you, June.